From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, want more Fox News in your life? Now, there's an app for that. Then playwright Luis Valdez talks about reaching diverse audiences through his work in theater, including his new play called Valley of the Heart.
It doesn't matter whether you're talking about farm workers or people working offices, you know. We are human beings and we're sentient human beings, and the heart is very important. And so I believe that by going through the heart, you get to the mind.
And Ana Da Silva from the feminist post-punk band The Raincoats talks about her new music and an important visit from Kurt Cobain. All that coming up today on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Netflix, presenting an original film from Academy Awards-winning directors Joel and Ethan Coen, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, an exploration of life's joys and woes set in the American frontier. Awards eligible on Netflix and in select theaters.
KPCC supporters include Fox Searchlight, presenting The Favorite, a royal tale of loyalty, power, and deception from director Yorgos Lanthimos, starring Olivia Colman as Queen Anne and Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz as the women of the court vying for her favor, now playing.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. A brand new streaming service launched today. It's called Fox Nation.
No holds barred talk from your favorite Fox personalities. Can't miss new specials and documentaries and more. All exclusively at your fingertips.
This is our time and this is going to be our place.
The streaming app costs $5.99 a month. It's been described as Netflix for conservatives. Stephen Battaglio covers TV and the media business for the LA Times, and he fills us in on what sets Fox Nation apart from Fox News.
If you think of the political rhetoric and right-wing commentary on Fox News as cocaine, Fox Nation is a uncut version of that. It is pure right-wing commentary that you can watch on demand at any time, and it's unfettered by any need to report the news. This is the driver for a lot of Fox fans, and Fox believes that people are going to be willing to pay for it in addition to watching Fox News on TV.
So there are a couple things that are happening as this is launched. One is that Fox News is incredibly profitable. It's making billions of dollars. And at the same time, millions of people are cutting their cords. They're dialing back on their cable or satellite subscriptions. So how is Fox News trying to position itself between those two things?
Fox News says that this is an additive product, a complementary product for people who can't get enough Fox News commentary and want to get it all the time on their mobile device over Roku. But really what it is that this is a way to get into the home that isn't subscribing to cable or may not subscribe to cable down the road. And every cable company is thinking about this. Every cable network is thinking about this because the cable bundle is slowly eroding. And with every canceled cable subscription or with every home that bypasses a cable or satellite TV subscription, that is lost revenue for a cable network.
So if Fox Nation isn't even trying to be fair and balanced, the Fox News slogan, what is it offering? What are the types of programs that people will see? And in some ways, might this be kind of the farm team for future Fox hosts that people can try out to see if they have the right stuff to make it to Fox News?
It has a lot of the familiar faces of Fox News. People like Brian Kilmeade from Fox and Friends, Dana Perino, they'll have their own shows that will be a little different than what they're able to do on the network. Dana Perino will do a show about books, for example, and Steve Doocy from Fox and Friends will do a cooking show. There are also newer, and I would say edgier personalities that have turned up on the network in commentary roles who are going to get a higher profile on this channel. People like Tyrus, a pro wrestler who has developed an interest in politics. He's a big tattooed guy with a backwards baseball hat. He doesn't really look like he belongs on Fox News, although he appears there quite often. And now he's going to have a show twice a week. And he probably is someone that a younger viewer who might stream would feel more comfortable with.
They are not yet saying how many subscribers they have, but other networks who have tried this, like CBS, what has the history been? Is this been something that has been relatively easy or difficult to get going?
CBS has CBS All Access, which at first started out as a way to stream the broadcast network signal over your mobile device or over your internet device. And over the last year, they've started investing and putting original programming on it. And they have about 2 or 3 million people, paying anywhere from $5.99 to $9.99 a month for it. And I think the question is that we have to be there because this is where the viewer is going. 18 to 34 viewers, that age group is spending less time every year watching traditional linear television. And if you don't have a platform to reach those people, your brand will be forgotten by them or not known by them at all. So it's a matter of just planting your flag in this new landscape and being there.
Stephen Battaglio covers television for the Los Angeles Times. Stephen, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
My pleasure.
And we have some sad news to report. The animation community in L.A. has lost a great talent. Steven Hillenburg was the creator of the wildly popular Nickelodeon series SpongeBob SquarePants. Hillenburg pulled from his background teaching marine biology for the show. He studied animation and fine art in grad school, where he made short films. His 1992 short Wormholes won the Best Animated Concept Award at the Ottawa International Animation Festival. And that's where he met Joe Murray, who suggested that Hillenburg consider working in TV. Murray at the time was developing his own Nickelodeon series, Rocco's Modern Life.
We were starting to staff up for Rocco, and I saw this film, and I said, I need to meet this guy. I could immediately see that he was really warped and really talented and really amazing. So I walked up to him. He had a backpack. He was like a student, and I introduced myself, and I said, would you ever consider working in television? And all of us were never really thinking about television because we were all independent filmmakers, But I told him that we were able to do some really amazing things on this show, and he laughed about it, and he says, well, let's talk about it. So I was able to talk him into it.
Hillenburg and his wife, Karen, have been longtime and very generous donors to KPCC, among many other arts and culture nonprofits. Stephen Hillenburg died yesterday at the age of 57 following a battle with ALS. Coming up, playwright and director Luis Valdez revisits California's Central Valley during World War II. Last Sunday, American soldiers fired tear gas on immigrants from Central America seeking asylum. Thousands are camped at the U.S.-Mexico border as more refugees arrive every day, fleeing violence and persecution. Those are conditions that, for playwright and director Luis Valdez, recall the same prejudices and injustices suffered by Japanese Americans at the start of World War II. When Valdez was a child, his family lived and worked on a Central California farm that was owned by a Japanese family. And that experience inspired Valley of the Heart. It's a play about two immigrant families, the Yamaguchis and the Montaños, and a love affair that is hindered by cultural differences and then ripped apart by the internment of Japanese Americans. When I spoke with Valdez, he recalled a neighbor from his childhood in the Central Valley named Esteban and how their friendship informed the characters in this play.
One day I went back to his place at about dinner time. They lived in a little shack. We all lived in shacks. Their kitchen was a cardboard lean-to, basically. And I discovered his mother was Japanese, and his father was Mexican. So there's that weird combination. And she cooked Mexican food like my mom, and also Japanese food, which was my first taste of that whole exotic cuisine. First taste of a rice ball came from her hands. And so I held on to that memory. I named the lovers after Esteban's parents. His father was Benjamin, or Benjamin. His mother was Thelma. And so Benjamin and Thelma became the lovers in my play.
I'll stand guard outside your house if you'd like, while you sleep.
I couldn't ask you to do that.
Then don't ask. I'll protect the home front.
Who would have thought my family would become victims of such hateful derision in the land of the free? I was born here, raised here. I went to school here. Don't they realize we're just as patriotic as anybody else?
When you are thinking about this period of American history, there are a couple of things that are very important, and I think the play addresses them. One is that both Mexican-American and Japanese-American families are feeding the nation. Mm. They are, and in your case, feeding soldiers at war. And yet, for political reasons, they are not fully American. And as soon as their services are essentially no longer needed, or Japanese-Americans are sent to internment camps, they're no longer part of the fabric of America. As a kid, did you understand that you were here, but really without a home, that you were disenfranchised, even as it felt that you were part of American society?
Yes, it's true that farm workers feed the nation, they feed the world, but they're the most despised group of laborers in the world over. This was the essence of my motivation for joining Cesar Chavez in 1965 to work with United Farm Workers, right? The evolution of that strike, the grape strike, which led to the creation of my theater company, El Teatro Campesino. And the objective was to prove that farm workers are as human as everybody else, and we have as many stories to tell, and really to fight for the dignity of farm laborers everywhere, whether they're Mexican, Okies, African-Americans, Filipinos, Asians, of any kind. It doesn't matter. Men, women, the injustices that attend to the people that work in the fields is outrageous.
When you are thinking about how you're going to dramatize this part of your own life and American history, what do you settle on? What are the things that were important to make sure that were represented? Because you have the internment of Japanese American, you have modern day sharecropping, you have forbidden love, and then you have the larger cultural issue of immigration. How do you figure out how you're going to tell that story most efficiently? How much of the true story are you going to retain, and how much are you going to have to make up?
Well, that's a good question. You take a stab in the dark, but you know the love story is to me the essence of any story. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about farm workers or people working offices, you know, high rises, whatever. We are human beings and we're sentient human beings, and the heart is very important. And so I believe that by going through the heart, you get to the mind. And this is true about teachers. This is about life in general and about all of the arts. I mean, this is why we love the arts, not just theater, but music, painting, films, everything. It allows us to be able to see with our hearts and to realize and logically, you know, what is right and what is wrong.
When you think about what has happened in the 5 years since this play was workshopped and refined, it feels as if the world is changing even faster than you can possibly keep up with in your play. Did you feel a temptation to make any updates to it, or are we just going to let it speak to history as it's being played out right now?
I think I really do truly believe that you can write a play in its own context if you can find it, and it will remain vital and alive and relevant. The fact is that as playwrights, you have to focus on the humanity of your characters, and if you focus honestly and truthfully, that reality will speak across generations. And it doesn't matter whether it's the 40s, the 30s, the 20s, or the latter half of the 21st century, people will not change fundamentally.
Your play ends very specifically on September 10th, 2001, one day before September 11th. And that's a period where we see a huge rise of Islamophobia in the United States. Do you feel that there is another story that you could tell that picks up essentially where this play ends?
Well, absolutely. I mean, again, one of my earliest experiences in farm labor was that everybody was out there, you know, right after the war, not just Mexicans, but also African-Americans from the South, you know, the refugees from slavery, basically. We had Asians out there. We had Chinese people, Japanese people, Filipinos, and Sikhs from India. So, and with the Okies and everyone else, you know, and the Puerto Ricans. I felt that, I mean, the whole world was out in the fields. And so there's wealth there. There is power there. There is dignity there. And those stories can only be told, I think, through the arts.
We're talking with Luis Valdez, who is the writer-director of the play Valley of the Heart. When you're performing with El Teatro Campesino, you're in the fields and people who are picking produce can see their lives and themselves reflected in a performance. Does that translate to some place like the Mark Taper Forum, where when I went and saw the play, it was a very diverse audience that people of all origins, but certainly a lot of Mexican-Americans, can go see a play where they see their own stories and people who look like themselves represented on stage.
I'm very happy and proud to be part of CTG, the Center Theater Group. It's been my second home in California. It's my home in Los Angeles. And to be able to come here and to work with a team of professionals are, of course, some of the people are from Teatro Campesino, are my brilliant costume designer, my wife, Lupe Trujillo, she's from Teatro Campesino. Some of the actors, the lead actor is our son. But, you know, it's not Hollywood nepotism, it's Teatro Campesino nepotism. We're a family of families. And so this is how we support ourselves. But having access to the taper stage has allowed me to address the people of Los Angeles and to give other Latino and also Asian actors and other people opportunity to come and to display their talents before the world at the center, at the Music Center.
Do you feel that you are telling American stories? Because I think there's an easy way for people to pigeonhole your stories as stories of Californians or Mexican Americans. Do you find that you feel that you're writing American plays?
I feel like an American playwright, absolutely. Yes, I'm of Mexican origin, but I mean, I grew up in the 1940s and 50s. All my teachers were old Anglos, you know, from the Midwest. And they taught me, man. They taught me to believe in the American dream like everybody else. And I know that there are great reasons to be cynical these days and to be full of hate and anger. And I went through that period in my 20s. But the fact is that I'm very grateful to the teachers that I've had. And ultimately, I believe in the fundamental principles that have guided this country for over 200 years. And I think we need to fight to retain that in every way. And it only requires a very basic day-to-day, daily decency from our leaders and from our politicians, not the lies and distortions that we're hearing publicly. So that's why I'm an activist. That's why my art, my theater, is about society and about people interacting with each other.
A big part of this story is about the internment of Japanese Americans.
They're just waiting for final instructions on the evacuation.
What evacuation?
Don't you read the headlines? President Roosevelt has ordered the army to move all Japanese Americans, aliens, and citizens from the whole West Coast.
They were no more or less patriotic. In fact, the Japanese American soldiers in World War II were the most decorated outfit in the American army. And yet we're at a time now where we're talking about Muslim ban and how we are judging people based on their appearance and their religion. Does it strike you that this story is actually more urgent today than it might have been even a couple of years ago?
I think it's unfortunately more urgent at the moment than it was when I started writing this, right, which is 2012, 2013, when we first produced it. Although I felt the urgency then, there's no question about that. I've been an activist most of my life, since my 20s, when I joined Cesar Chavez, and I consider our work with El Teatro Campesino still part of that social activism, but using the arts as our working tool, our arts to reach people and to raise their consciences and to hope that they become active also. But I think that, yes, the elements that we're dealing with now have a burning urgency. They're like the fires that we see all over L.A. and up north. These fires are burning, and the fires of injustice are upon us. And we have to deal with the smoke. We have to deal with the inability to be able to live comfortably, you know, with so much obvious injustice and corruption around us.
Luis Valdez is the writer and director of Valley of the Heart. It's at the Mark Taper Forum through December 9th. Luis, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, feminist punk musician Ana Da Silva talks about her music, both old and new.
Sorry I made you cry. Won't you forgive me, dear? Go, Manasai. Nights have been lonely.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix original film, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. From the incomparable minds of Joel and Ethan Coen comes a six-part anthology film, original stories that only they could tell. Set against the harsh and unforgiving backdrop of the American frontier, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs is an exploration of life's joys and woes. Winner of the best screenplay at the Venice Film Festival, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, on Netflix and now playing in select theaters.
KVCC supporters include Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, a royal tale of loyalty, power, and deception from director Yorgos Lanthimos, starring Olivia Colman, Emma Stone, Rachel Weisz, Nicholas Hoult, Joe Alwyn, and Mark Gatiss, now playing in select theaters.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. And now an excerpt from I'm in the Band. It's a podcast about women in punk music from Allison Wolf and The Frame's Jonathan Shiflett. The focus in this episode is Ana Da Silva. Her band, The Raincoats, was hugely influential after launching in the 1970s. Da Silva has a new album called Island, made with a Japanese musician known as Few. Da Silva started by talking about the time that Kurt Cobain came to visit her in London.
When he came to talk to me, I didn't know who he was. Later I found out it was Nirvana. So we never really talked about anything, but he was being really shy and going, when I listen to your music, I fall on the floor or something like that. I saw these crazy Americans. My name is Ana Da Silva. My full name is quite big. It's Ana Paula de Lima Peter Da Silva. I'm a founder member of the Raincoats. I was born in Madeira, which is a Portuguese island. It was a small town where I lived, 100,000 people. We didn't have an airport at the time. We didn't have television in Madeira. There weren't many newspapers, and they only came sporadically. So it was very cut off from culture, from other places. It was only when I went to Lisbon, to the university, that I started having more things to look at and to listen to. And there was also a political system that was very stifling. And then at the end of my course in 1974, there was a revolution.
Censorship was at an end, freedom of speech restored, elections promised, and most important of all, the end of Portugal's colonial wars in Africa.
It's called the Carnation Revolution because the soldiers that were going in the streets had put carnations in their guns. And mainly it was because the army was fed up of going to these stupid wars that nobody was going to win, and that you only lose in wars anyway.
200,000 people took to the streets, strewing red carnations and dancing with the troops.
And the students were making some demonstrations and meetings whereby people would speak about it, and there would be revolutionary songs as well against the status quo and all that. While I was still at university, my sister gave me an acoustic guitar, and I just sit there in my bedroom playing, you know, John Baez songs and Bob Dylan songs.
Oh, all the money in my whole life I spent.
And a friend of mine used to say, I should go to London and get a band. I just used to think she was crazy, saying something like that, because to me that was crazy. And then I came to London, I went to art school, and that's where I met Gina. And at that time, when I was at art school, punk started. The thing that inspired us to start a band was the punk idea that you didn't really need to know how to play very well. You just had to have something to say and had the energy to do it. That was one thing. But seeing the Slits playing, and I had heard other women playing things. I loved Joan Baez and Joni Mitchell, but it was a different thing. I never thought I could ever do that. These girls, you know, they didn't know exactly what they were doing, but they had so much to say. Just the fact that they were even just there.
Stop here! This is for you as my love that was for nobody.
When we started the band, my ideal actually was having two women and two men, because I thought that was the thing that you should strive for. But when we were all women, it was really good.
We're meant to go. We're meant to go.
Yeah, after the Raincoats, I did the solo album called The Lighthouse, which was done on a small synthesizer, I suppose, that had lots of sounds in it and the sequencer, and I did the whole album on that. For me, that was a bit like digital punk or something. The modular thing is a bit complicated, and you have to. I don't have mates or, you know, friends that do the thing, and you talk about it. I have to read about it and look on YouTube to learn what you do. But basically, you have a wire coming from one, and it can go pretty much anywhere, and that's when the modules relate, which is amazing. So it's not like I have a clear idea of what I'm going to do, but the instrument is giving me something back as well, and it takes over your life completely, because all you can think of is, which is my next module. When the Raincoats went to Japan, we played with this woman called Fiu. The person that took us to Japan, he said, oh, you must one day do something with you. I said, oh, yeah, sure, you know. So I said, shall we do it? Do you really want to do this? How shall we do it? You know, she said, oh, we could just do we transfer. So that's what we did. I do some stuff with this modular synthesizer, recorded it onto my computer, send her the files, then she add more tracks to them. And that's how we did the whole album.
And that is our show for today. Remember, you can get The Frame as a podcast wherever you like to listen. You can also find some of our stories on LAIST, that's LAIST.com. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.